When I was BMF at Apple.com, I told them it stood for Be My Friend. So we'll go with that.
Welcome to Debug. Joining me, as always, is Guy English. How are you, Guy?
Good, thanks.
And today we are talking to Mike Lee from the new Lemurs. How are you, Mike?
I'm great, thanks.
Did I pronounce Lemurs correctly? I'm not certain.
Well, I say lemurs. But, you know, whatever.
All right. How are you?
Yeah, great.
You have a big personality. You have a big persona. You have a big reputation in the iOS and Mac developer community. I'm sure people know you from many things, Delicious Monster, Tapulous. How did you get your start developing in general?
Well, you know, I worked for this airline for quite some years on the ground crew. And I met a lot of really interesting people and got a lot of really good advice. And, you know, one of those pieces of advice was that I should look into having a skill if I didn't want to be doomed to a life of hard labor. And, you know, it was a pretty dangerous job, the kind of thing where people got hurt or killed. And at a certain point, I started to feel like, you know, that my life was in danger if I didn't get a skill. So I taught myself to code and, you know, eventually ended up writing code for the airline.
It was Java, right? If I, just for the record.
Yeah. No, like, mostly Java stuff at that point. Yeah.
We're all pals. So I'm kind of.
You're filling in the blanks as you go
interject with like pertinent stuff every now and then. So yeah, you started writing Java for the airline.
Yeah. It was really funny because they weren't really a Java shop. And I was kind of, you know, I was like fighting for Java. It's kind of.
What were they?
.NET, I guess. I mean, the whole situation was weird, you know, because the airline had an IT department, but they didn't, you know, they had a hard time getting them to deliver what they needed. And so, you know, we were people who had the skill, but there wasn't really a place for us. And so they ended up kind of sneaking us in under the auspices of being web content publishers. And, you know, we were just kind of this rogue force within the airline, but we ended up delivering and being noticed very quickly at kind of the higher echelons. And, you know, once a certain sort of senior vice president took an interest in what we were doing, then, you know, we just kind of became the go-to guys because, the FAA would come to the airline and say something like, you know, you need to change the way that you're, you know, doing the terrorist watch list and you have until Monday or else it's $1 million a day fine. And so, you know, they'd go to the IT department and they'd say, well, we could have a spec sheet for you in about a month. And then they would, you know, go to me and I'd say, well, I'll work on it this weekend and see what I can come up with and then have something kind of hacked up, you know, by Monday.
So was that it? Like you interacted with the IT department or you could take their stuff or was it more like segmented?
No, we didn't interact with them at all. I mean, they, you know, eventually they figured out what we were doing and they tried everything they could to kind of prevent us from doing what we were doing. They really didn't like us at all. and I mean, the reason why I was using Java was not because I was some, you know, fanatic for Java. I didn't know anything. Right. You know, I asked them to provide me with a machine. And to, you know, give me the latest version of .NET or whatever it was that they were using. And they basically said no. And so I was just using my personal machine, which was a Mac. And so obviously .NET wasn't going to be it. So I used Java instead. And then I fought for using Java, you know, partially because I started really liking what I was reading about Java and mm-hmm. partially because it was what I had the ability to use.
Yeah. So what year was this really?
I guess this would have been the early 2000s. Yeah. You know, I think, you know, probably 2005 was when I left. So I had been probably programming for 2 years.
And so, yeah. So when you left, it's an interesting story, right? Why don't you, get into that?
Well, you know, so basically what had happened was, you know, we had become very much kind of these, big fish in a little pond and, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. It was completely self-taught. And you know, I look back now and shudder at some of the mistakes that I made. But we were willing to do something, which kind of made us the, you know, like I said, the go-to guys. And eventually the airline decided they needed to get rid of some people. And it was very difficult for them to get rid of people because there's kind of, a, you know, airlines are union shops. But programmers are not, there's no programmers union. And so, you know, we were considered part of management, and management in general is the kind of the opposite of the union. And so they basically said, anyone in management who's willing to leave the company will give you some benefits and some money. And so I thought, you know, what a great time to go indie. And, you know, took about a year salary and benefits and left and went to my first WWDC. That was in 05. And, you know, did the whole conference on $100, right? Kind of famously, which I spent on a hotel, kind of far from Moscone. I got a student scholarship because I was taking some classes. And, you know, I used my flight benefits to fly down there. But then when I got to WWDC and was actually faced with people who actually did know what they were doing, I was, humiliated, embarrassed. I mean, I don't know. I was just really, you know, suddenly felt like I didn't know anything. And, you know, I spent kind of the first 24 hours furiously hacking and reading and trying to learn and trying to catch up. And this idea that I had, you know, kind of gone in with, that I was some kind of hot shit that was going to, you know, to take the world by storm, was kind of turned on its head. And I realized that I needed somebody who knew what they were doing to teach me how to do this stuff. And
you,
I had
so,
met.
Yeah. So you've been going into the sessions now, right? Like you had to take it. So
Yeah. Into the sessions. And not only that, because I had a student ticket, I got to go to the student day. And, you know, of course they had a, at this point, rather infamous speech by industry legend, Will Shipley. And I had been very impressed because, you know, I mentioned I was taking some classes, you know, I had taken a class on business, and it was one of these classic situations where you had to write a business plan. And I had this whole notion in my head that if you wanted to make a software company, you could really get around this whole cost of goods sold issue by just kind of working in a coffee shop and, you know, working on your laptop. And, you know, as long as you could find some way to pay your rent or live without having to pay rent, then you could pretty much have a zero burn rate. Mm-hmm. And run a company this way. And, you know, my professor laughed in my face and said that it was a very naive idea of business. And so when this guy gets up, you know, puts his balls on the table and basically says he works out of a coffee shop, I thought this is the guy that I should talk to.
And so you introduced yourself after the talk or what?
Yeah, well, not entirely. You know, I had a couple of days first, so I kind of formulated a plan, if you will.
Worked and, up to it.
Yeah, you know, kind of worked my way up to it. And, you know, the idea that I came up with was, you know, I have a year of salary in the bank. I have a year of benefits. You know, I could work for someone for free for a year. And this guy just happens to live in the same general vicinity where I live. So, I mean, I'll work for him for free for a year. And I ran into him, you know, walking through the hall, and I kind of gave him, you know, blurted this all out at him. And I think his initial reaction was one of just sort of bafflement.
Understandably.
Well, sure. But then, you know, sort of fate interceded. They ended up winning the design award for Delicious Library. Mm-hmm. And he ends up being on the same bus as me on the way back from the campus bash, so that when he's ready to basically go out and get drunk and celebrate, I happen to be right there. And so he slaps me on the back and's like, let's go party. So I kind of had that, you know, that night to get to know him and to become friends with him. You know, such that when we went back to Seattle, you know, we started calling each other on the phone and, you know, just talking about random friendly bullshit. And, you know, this idea that I had of working together, you know, started to look like something that we could actually do. We had a little bit of a back and forth when, you know, he had this real worry that, working together would destroy our friendship. You know, but I was so keen to, you know, to get into the business and to learn this stuff, you know, is kind of my whole thing. So I'm a bit monomaniacal in that way. So I kind of pushed forward and overcame his objections and ended up living in his basement, getting rid of everything, you know, and doing kind of the most internal internship that can possibly be done.
Developer monk.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm. And how was that? Like, so what was your experience working with Will? Because he's clearly a very experienced guy, and he's got very opinionated. And the product that you did, Delicious Library 2, very well received and very good app. Was it like a tough development?
It was a very tough development, first of all, because, you know, it took us 3 years, and the whole time we were working on it, we were 1 month from shipping.
So it was you, Will, and Lucas Newman, right?
Lucas Newman, yeah.
And who was the designer on that one? Because Mike Mattis had left by then, I believe, right?
Adam Betts was our designer.
Right.
Yeah. We did a bit of fumbling around, I think, in the design department, but eventually managed to get enough of Adam's time to put together something coherent.
So how are those 3 years? Because you were, I mean, you'd started out just learning, and by the time that had shipped, you had a ton of experience, right?
Yeah, I did. I kind of break that period into 3 1-year periods. It's a bit tidy in my mind, but that's kind of how I see it. There was kind of that initial year when it was very much about, you know, the family, right? Me and Will and Lucas and my wife at the time, Mary, and you know, it was the most frustrating thing, I think, at the time was that, you know, Will was very much still kind of celebrating the success of Delicious Library, and Lucas and I were very eager to work on it. But we did have some times when we would sit down and work on it in earnest. I mean, we did have a month when we did nothing but play Puzzle Pirates. You know, not because we wanted to, but because Will insisted that that's what we were going to do for that month. But, you know, we did learn a lot, and you know, we'd have a lot of like code reviews and a lot of these kinds of discussions with Will. You know, I think of that as kind of the best time, you know, that first year. You know, but then, you know, Will ended up getting a girlfriend and she moved in. And so it was kind of awkward for us to be living there. And so we moved out, and it changed the whole kind of tenor of the company, because, you know, it used to be that we would wake up at a normal time and go work in the coffee shop. And then sometime in the late afternoon, Will would wake up and he would join us. We'd work for a couple of hours, and then, you know, we'd get up and go to some restaurant or something and have, you know, dinner. And then, you know, that's kind of the time when we would talk about work and when we would learn stuff and question things. You know, and then, you know, Will would go kind of lay in bed overnight and do a bunch of, you know, coding. You know, people are always like, when does the guy ever do his work? It's during this sort of insomnia evenings that he has. And that cycle would repeat, and that worked out okay. But then when he had a girlfriend, instead what would happen is he would come join us for about 5 minutes, and then he'd be like, let's all go to a restaurant. And then he would be like, no talking about code because you're going to bore my girlfriend. You know, and then we started to get very frustrated. And, you know, also this sort of month-long death march had been going on for, you know, 2 years at this point. You know, I was very sort of stubbornly determined to stick it out. Lucas, I think, you know, kind of got wise. The iPhone came out, and you know, Lucas ended up going to Apple. And that sort of, you know, led into the third year, which was the part where Will kind of thought that I had already left the company because Lucas had left the company. And so he kind of treated me like I wasn't there anymore, but I was there. So, you know, I kind of ended up being kind of very independent and on my own and kind of finding my own way and sort of having these increasing clashes when kind of Will and I would come together and disagree on, you know, the implementation of this or that feature or something like that.
Well, it's bound to happen if you're in close quarters and, you know,
oh, and inevitably. And
a big
and,
gap like that.
You know, the person who really saved my ass on that one was Brent Simmons. You know, because, you know, I you know, Lucas had given me one, well, he'd given me a couple really good pieces of advice, but one really good piece of advice he gave me was go out there and meet the community and actually find out what's going on for your own and form your own opinions and things like this. You know, so I ended up kind of going and meeting the local scene, and that included Brent Simmons. And when I would sort of complain to him about, you know, how I felt like I was, you know, really butting heads with Will, he told me that this is something that happens, and that, you know, when he was with his mentor, Dave Weiner, that these very same situations happened, and he would sort of regale me these old stories of working for Dave, and they were the same stories, you know, and it made me realize that this is something that everybody goes through. And he told me that, you know, what this means is that you're ready to move on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've snatched the pebble, and it's time for you to go. You know, but I was still stubbornly determined to ship Delicious Library. You know, I had gotten a bit of a shipping sickness, if you will. You know, I basically submitted my resignation. So I said, basically, I'm out of here, you know, when we ship 1.1. and let's call it that. And then he basically wrote back and said, he was at TED at the time, so he was in a really good mood. And he was like, yeah, don't worry about it. You know, keep your computer. You know, I'll give you a couple months pay. And, you know, you did good work. You know, good luck out there.
So when you did ship, how do you feel? Excited? Like a weight off or what?
Well, because that was the thing, was that I wasn't there.
And oh, so I thought you'd, yeah. Well, it shipped very soon after though, didn't it?
It did ship very soon afterward. And, you know, it really hurt a lot because I had worked on this thing for 3 years and, you know, the extent of my sacrifice, had sort of become known at this point. You know, I, you know, things with my wife fell apart. You know, and I very much found myself, I mean, when I left Delicious Monster, first of all, you have to understand, I had never in my life left a job and then gone on and gotten a better job. I had always changed my whole career. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in a place where the economy was bad and you always had to hustle for the next thing. And, you know, so I really didn't know how to go from one job to another. And I genuinely thought that was it. And that was my 3 years of coding. And now I had to do something else. You know, and they shipped without me. And I remember once telling Lucas that the one thing that I feared the most was being left behind. And,
well, I mean, everything you contributed was still in the app, right? It's not like it was all for naught.
Yeah, true. But I mean, you know, this comes down to the metaphor of, you know, of having a child, you know, and it's why I hate doing contract work, because it's like it costs me years of my life when I do this work. You know, this isn't something that I can casually sit down and do. Every line of code I write is costing me something. You know, the way that having children isn't free, you know, and giving birth to a baby and handing it over to somebody else, you know, that surrogate mother role, it's not something that I like. And it's something that I've been kind of forced in, you know, again and again in my career. And it's kind of given me a kind of madness, you know, that I really traces back to that first time with Delicious Library. Because if you look after that, you know, I went to Tapulous and got, you know, the boot like a week before it was on stage with Steve, you know, went to, you know, to Apple and worked on the, you know, the app store that shipped a month after I left. I mean.
So you think you got a sickness?
A shipping sickness.
Is it a closure thing that you don't get to see it and you'll almost leave the harbor and go out into the world?
I mean, that's kind of it, isn't it? It's like, it's like having a movie on a bad DVD where right before the ending, the thing skips back to the beginning again.
So, yeah. Okay. So after you left Delicious, what happened?
My phone started to ring. Yeah. And it turned out that, you know, because of the iPhone, which, you know, I was very excited about, you know, it turned out that people who had this obscure Objective-C programming skill were somewhat in demand. You know, somebody asked me to give them a quote and I had no idea. Like I had no idea what number to say. Like the last time I had made an hourly wage, it was, you know, $9.25 an hour or whatever working for the airline. So I wasn't, really set up for that. So, you know, I called my friend.
$9.50 an hour.
or whatever, you know,
cost of living.
You know, I think I called, I think I called Chris,
Parrish. You know.
Yeah, Chris Parrish. I called Chris Parrish up and I was, because they were doing contract work for Adobe at the time. And I was like, what are you guys charging an hour? And he's like, you know, well, I think we're charging like $100 or something, right? So I was like, okay, $100. Then I get a call from like, you know, I heard you've been asked to bid on this project and, you know, look, I really need that project. And, I was like, okay, well, no problem. Like, I'll just bid higher than you. You know, and what are you bidding? And he's like, well, I bid $125. And I was like, oh, well, fine, I'll bid $150. So I bid $150. And then inexplicably, I got the project. well, yeah, I did. I mean, whoops was kind of my reaction. I felt really bad about it.
It's business. Yeah.
I suppose so. I ended up dropping the project halfway through, you know, going down to California to start Tapulous and, you know, doing my damnedest to send that project back to, I don't think it ever quite found its way home.
So how did the Tapulous thing start up?
So it was very much the same kind of thing where my phone's ringing. And, you know, I think I kind of went from utter despair to, holy crap, people are willing to pay me more money than I've ever seen in my life for doing the thing that I love doing the most, despite the fact that I got into it knowing full well there was no money in it. You know, like everything had just sort of turned around and changed. And it was like, oh, my God. You know, I felt like, I don't know, a debutante or something, you know, it was like everybody wanted me.
And, you were being courted.
Very much so. And it was
well,
a
the
weird
iPhone
feeling.
Really opened up that market, right?
No, it really did. I mean, that was the thing that immediately became clear. It very much came clear that my weirdly, the, you know, the sun and the moon and the stars and my hobbies had all aligned and I was onto something. And so all of a sudden I'm taking phone calls left and right. And it's just, it's a totally new thing for me. And this is the first time in my life when anybody's given a crap about me. Right. So just really excited about this. And then I get this phone call from these guys who I have to admit now, like I immediately did not like, right. Like it was just, you know, everybody was intent to talk to me on iChat. You know, but these guys insisted on having a phone call with me. And I remember telling them like, well, look, despite the fact that I was not doing a damn thing, I'm like, look, I'm really busy right now. You know, you can call me in an hour, you know, thinking that they would go away. And then inexplicably they called me in an hour. So I ended up talking to them and they're like, you know, come fly down to California. And at the time, the idea of having somebody else fly me to California was very novel. So I'm like, okay, I'll fly down. I'll listen to their shtick. I'll tell them that I'm not interested and I'll come home. So I ended up flying down and they were telling me, you know, well, they introduced me to just, you know, a bunch of engineers and stuff. And I thought that was really nice. And they were really nice people. And, you know, they basically told me that what they'd done is they kind of bought up all the popular jailbreak apps. And their strategy was that when the App Store came out on day zero, they would basically have a million users before anybody and have a momentum that would be completely unstoppable.
So who were the engineers that were there at the time? I know Nate was there, right? Nate Chu.
Nate was there, you know, hanging around in the way that that Nate does. You know, I'd say Thomas, you know, Timus, what the heck is his last name? Muldowney was there.
Layton?
Sean Heber was there. Layton was there, but, you know, Layton was never part of Tapuous, right? Like they had their own thing with Polar Bear Labs. They were kind of like friends of Tapuous, working next door to Tapuous, contracting on some Tapuous projects when we could, you know, convince them to do so. This guy named Phil, who later went on to, you know, to be a pain in Apple's ass with his Ninja Words app.
What was Ninja Words?
Ninja Words was, it started out as kind of, I think, a Ruby thing when Ruby was the thing, and then eventually it became an app. And then, you know, it was one of these things where like it got rejected for having the wrong age rating. And then the developer made a huge stink about it. And then I think Phil Schiller or somebody, you know, big like that came out and were like, look, like if you include, you know, the slang dictionary and the slang dictionary has a hell of cuss words, then you're going to have to put an age rating on it. And yeah. I just remember thinking to myself, oh, God, it's that guy again. Yeah. And like Sean Heber was there. Did I mention that?
Yeah, a good crowd.
Yeah, I nice guys, right? Nice guys. And they were really kind of, I mean, you know, basically a lot of really interesting guys in the jailbreak scene, you know, which I'd always just sort of been hovering around, you know, because like Lucas got really into the jailbreak stuff and I was like forbidden from doing anything iPhone by Will. And so I was always sort of sniffing around and looking at the stuff. So to, you know, be introduced to all the, you know, all these jailbreak guys, it was kind of, had become this epicenter for, you know, jailbreak. You know, there were no iPhone guys, right? So these were the iPhone guys and being there with them, being in the Valley, all of it, like it all just felt really, really nice, you know, really, really
we
nice.
Should point out that this is before the SDK, like,
at least
6 months.
Yeah. Way before any of that stuff. Back when, you know, you couldn't buy test devices and you couldn't use your devices without, you know, locking them up once in a while.
So the plan is to ship a whole bunch of apps.
Well, I mean, it's not so much the plan was to ship a whole bunch of apps. I mean, we had a portfolio of about 40 apps, you know, and we kind of started with 40 and worked our way down and, you know, it sort of, you know, have these product decision meetings where we kind of narrow things down, you know, until we got to kind of like the top 10, and then, you know, narrowed it down further to kind of the three that we could manage to produce by the deadline and the three that would come next, and so on and so forth. You know, the idea was to...
What were the first three? Was it Twinkle, TTR, TapTap, Revenge?
Yeah,
and Revenge there? Or Revolution? Revolution was the jailbreak one, right?
Revolution was the jailbreak one. Revenge was the
first. Yeah. And what was the third app?
Friendbook.
All right, Friendbook, yeah. So Twinkle was an early Twitter client.
Yes. Twinkle was an early Twitter client. You know, we introduced the location feature to Twitter, and we introduced
reliability. Yeah, you had your own backend to handle it, right?
It was a whole idea, right? Because at the time, the big problem with Twitter is we all assumed it was going to be going away because they couldn't manage to keep their servers running. And the hot shit at that time was to make these kind of replacement Twitter-like services. And, you know, I was like, hell that. Let's, you know, let's use what we have, this Twinkle backend service. I mean, the thing that people don't understand is that Tapulous was supposed to be this big, like, server infrastructure play. And the apps were just a demonstration of the platform to be in the original plan, right? And so the whole point was to use stuff that would leverage the backend. And so the whole idea with Twinkle was, you know, we'll build our big backend. We'll put it on top of Twitter. Twitter goes down all the time. We won't go down. And people will be super impressed with our backend because our Twitter client is so awesome. And if Twitter happens to go away, then we'll just absorb their service into our backend. And
yeah, it was a very different thing when it started out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is that the backend team never really materialized, and the front end team ended up being, you know, super awesome. So, you know, it became an app company.
How did you choose those three apps? Was it what you thought would be best in the market, or how much work you'd have to put into them from a coding or development side?
No, really, what it comes down to is that. They each sort of had their own stories. For me, the central focus was TapTap because it was about music, and it was the one thing that I knew. Apple is a music company. They get music. You know, Steve loves music. You know, this is the app that we have that is most likely to be on stage with Steve Jobs because it's about music. It was a game, which I didn't like, you know, but it was about music. And so I knew that, you know, that had to happen. Twinkle was just for us. Like, we were Twitter users. We were super in love with the idea of Twitter at the time. You know, it gave us the ability to just do amazing things, you know, to not only, I mean, the location stuff was so awesome at the time because there were so few people on Twitter, that all of a sudden it really seemed to make Twitter seem like it was everywhere. And it gave it this kind of like magical feeling. You know, I had all these great experiences. Like, you know, we drove through the desert and, you know, there'd be these tweets from like weeks before. And it was like, you know, these like ghost voices, really incredible. And then Friendbook was kind of like, that was kind of a weird case because this idea of social networking, social graph, social crap, you know, this was like real hot at the time. And, you know, it's like every day, you know, my partners had this tendency to go out and talk to people and get really excited about some buzzword and come in and be like, okay, here's what we're doing. You know, the whole company is changing. Here's what we're doing now. And so as the sort of, you know, head of engineering, I had a lot of kind of pushback from engineering about the kind of crazy crap going on, you know, at the top. And so, you know, the first thing I did was try to kind of separate engineering from everything else so that kind of, you know, it was like, okay, when you have stuff you want to talk about, good or bad, you come talk to me and then I'll relay it to engineering. You know, that way they can keep doing what they're doing and not be bothered because, you know, we're all, yeah, they're insulated. And we were all working very, very hard. You know, you got to understand we had a deadline, like we're working our asses off. And so basically whenever these ideas about, you know, the address book and the social graph and all of this kind of, you know, buzzword stuff that was going on in the Valley at the time would come to me, I would just implement that into this sort of sync for that kind of crap, which was called Friendbook. And, you know, for my own amusement, I was, you know, doing some innovation on top of it. You know, I was reading a lot about the visual cortex at the time. I think I had met, you know, Bill Atkinson or whoever it was that was going around from the original Mac team, and they said a bunch of stuff about the visual cortex that got me really interested in it. And so I was like, if you had a visual dialer where you could just see your friends' faces, then you could dial the phone a lot faster. And then like Nicholas Jitkoff from Google had this like crazy idea about like putting two phones together and shaking them and using the accelerometer as some kind of like, you know, way of matching them. And I was like, oh, it's awesome because you can make it like you're shaking hands and it'll be called like handshaking and you can exchange your address cards. And so, you know,
I found pretty cool, I got to say.
Yeah, yeah, it was totally a cool feature.
Oh, well, Nicholas Jitkoff is not just of Google. What's the famous launcher thing that he did?
Yeah, Quicksilver, of course.
Quicksilver.
That's what he was best known for, yeah. So, I mean, you know, it was like Friendbook was basically the dumping place for ideas. You know, TTR was the princess to be protected. And then, you know, Twinkle was so that we could have a better Twitter client.
So how was launch day? Day one? Because all of these were on the App Store day one, right?
Yeah, kind
of.
I mean,
very much on the cutting edge of...
The problem, you know, Apple underestimated the amount of interest that was out there. And their infrastructure basically collapsed under the weight of that interest. And, you know, so we were all told basically that if we got our binaries in by, you know, this time on this day, that we would be there at day zero of the App Store. But then when the App Store started to come online, our stuff wasn't there. And, you know, I was basically our company's ambassador for Apple. In fact, I very often felt like the main reason why they wanted me, in the first place was because I had a lot of friends who worked at Apple. You know, by which, you know, like I knew the evangelism team, for example. So I could like, you know, say, hey, what's going on? You know, like bug Matt Drance, right? Poor Matt Drance, man. You can ask him how much I would talk to him at that time.
We had him on earlier.
I know. I listened to that episode. It was a really good one.
He's great.
But, you know, so there had been a little bit of political stuff because of all these jailbreak apps we had. And I think that Apple, you know, they didn't like jailbreak. They knew the advantage that we had with our jailbreak portfolio, and they kind of didn't want us to succeed because of that. And so, like, I remember having this conversation with Matt where I'm just like, you know, have I thrown in with the wrong people? Like, have I damned my, you know, reputation at Apple because, you know, because I'm now associated with this jailbreak stuff? And, you know, it's kind of like, well, maybe not you, but jailbreak. And, you know, it was very clear that, you know, that Apple were not fond of us. And it was especially frustrating because other, you know, projects I knew about, which I had been much less impressed by than the stuff that we were working on, you know, were talking to Apple and getting all kinds of help and you know, were getting featured and stuff like that. And, you know, I kind of felt a little bit screwed by that.
And it's not entirely fair because, despite the fact that you guys started with jailbreak, like I saw that code and porting it from pre iOS 2.0, pre open App Store stuff, that's a big job.
It was a total rewrite. I mean, we had to do everything over again.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know,
in short order, because again, sort of the company expects that, well, they already have the apps, but in reality, you have to sort of redo them. So.
No, that's right. I mean, you know more than anybody, just, you know, just how much we ended up having to kind of redo all of that stuff. And we didn't just have to redo it once. We had to redo it every time a new beta of the SDK would come out.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, it was an incredible amount of work. But I mean,
I think it paid off. You got in there early and you had success, right?
No, it absolutely did pay off. And I mean, John Galenzi, I remember, you know, gave me this particular piece of advice of, you know, not being concerned with short term and being strategic and, you know, looking at things in the long term. You know, 4 years from now, it's not going to matter who's, you know, there on the first day and kind of things like this. But I mean, it's really funny because, you know, I my frustration evaporated when it finally became clear, you know, because I mean, you know, the whole weekend, you know, people in evangelism were like, look, the store is coming online. Like, you know, we said it would be, you know, like Monday morning, you know, just wait. And then Monday morning comes around and we're still not there. And at that point, my frustration just evaporated because, you know, I immediately knew like these guys are fucked. These guys are fucked because they promised all these people something and they're not delivering it. And the only way that that would come to pass is if these guys are just, they're working as hard as we are and they're just, they're completely overwhelmed. And I suddenly felt very sort of compassionate toward what those guys were going through. And so, you know, with kind of everything falling apart around me and everything seeming like it was on fire, it was just kind of 100th cup of coffee thing where everything became very slow. And I wrote Michael Jurowitz, you know, an email or hit him up on iChat. And I basically said, look, I have a feeling of what's going on over there. And when I'm in that situation, you know, I want some coffee and some pastry is about all my stomach can handle. You know, how about I swing by the Starbucks and, you know, pick some goodies up for you and drop them off there at Infinite Loop. And he was like, yeah, cool. So that's what I did. You know, so my partners are like, you know, crawling up my ass when they know what's going on. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I'm just going to buy these guys some pastry.
Well, I think it's telling that, you know, that day they released the iPhone 3G, they released iOS 2, and they released the App Store. And they've never done anything like that all in one day ever again. Ever since then, they've split it up over a couple days.
Well, makes sense to, you know, yeah. Once bitten, twice shy, I guess, you know.
I mean, I don't think they would have done it, you know, that way then. It's just, you know. They just had no idea what they were sitting on yet.
So what happens next?
Well,
just a few months, right? Like,
yeah. I mean, there were a couple of things. So, you know, it's really funny. I remember when I first started working with these guys and I had this conversation with Bart and, you know, he told me we're talking about blind spots and about the importance with partners of kind of filling in each other's blind spots. And I remember just so distinctly the moment when everything changed. And that was the moment when, you know, we hit number one with Tap Tap Revenge. Right. And, you know, there's a picture of us. We popped the champagne, you know, we were all very excited. I think it took us about a week. And Bart said, the only thing that concerns me is that when we were climbing up the charts, the only place for us to go is up. And now that we're number one, the only place for us to go is down. And at the time, I gave a very, you know, engineer's answer of, you know, well, that's why we need to keep working on the next thing and the next thing so that when the inevitable product life cycle hits us, you know, we're already ready with the next hit.
Was that redemptive for you to get to number one, to have that giant Tap Tap banner in the Apple atrium?
You know, there are these times when you're successful beyond your wildest dreams and, you know, you're just kind of floored by your luck, by your success, by whatever. In this case, you know, we had a plan, we executed that plan and the plan, you know, that's what happened. It was gratifying in the way that, you know, reaching your goal is gratifying, but it wasn't like, you know, knock you on your ass. Can't believe it happened to you. Oh my God. Exciting. And more than that, I mean, that was just part of the plan and there was a lot more plan to be executed. And so I was largely concerned with the next step and the next step. I mean, we did still have a bunch of other apps in our pipeline. And I think we were under pressure to produce something like an app a month, which we negotiated down from an app a day.
that was a bit optimistic.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I mean, there was a fundamental difference between the, you know, basically between Bart and Andrew and the rest of the company, right? And you see these cracks, and I just ignored this crap. You know, because I was so concerned about the actual job of engineering. Right. But you know, you look at interviews from us, you know, back then when things were, you know, were going great and you really were getting two different stories. You know, you had me coming off of Delicious Library talking about, you know, what apps should be and this sort of design focused way of doing things and, you know, basically seeing this as the ascendancy of Apple and their ethos. And then you had Bart and Andrew saying, we want to be the Rock You, we want to be the Slide, we want to, you know, be the App Factory.
Right.
And, you know, they acquired App A Day, you know, which was, you know, Sean Heber's thing where he did like one proof of concept every day for 30 days. They bought him out, you know, I guess thinking that he would be like a golden goose that would lay an app every day. You know, but actually taking one of these proofs of concept and bringing it to the point when I felt like it was marketable product, that was much harder. That, you know, that would take at least a month.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I mean, it's easy to sort of knock out a prototype. It's a lot more work to actually build a product.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And I think that, you know, there's something of a disconnect there. You know, we were definitely, you know, overworked and on a crazy schedule. You know, and once TapTap hit number one and kind of people started going insane, you know, that only got worse. I remember, you know, at one point being up for something like 10 days without more than a couple hours of sleep and, you know, finally getting some sleep. I think when we hit the deadline, you know, and then like 4 hours later, my phone ringing and, just, you know, I just couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe that.
Right.
Like I've never worked so hard in my life, you know, as I did, you know, Tapulous and then the immediate aftermath of Tapulous, you know, United Lemur, the Obama app, like that period of time, 2008, I've never worked so hard.
So yeah, so basically Tapulous kind of flew apart at the seams at one point, right?
Yeah. And, you know, really what happened was, you know, like they never liked Louis. I always fought for Louis because I knew that Louis had incredible talent. You know, they wanted to work with Brian Bell. And I thought, you know, Brian Bell's great, but man, there's something in this Mantia kid, you know, and yeah, his stuff is too flat. And yeah, you know, he doesn't know how to use 3D, but, you know, and yes, he's definitely obnoxious, but goddamn, the kid had talent. I mean, you know, working for Will Shipley, you know, had taught me to look for Mike Mattis. Mm-hmm. And I saw Mike Mattis in Louis Mantilla, and I wasn't going to let that go. That was to me more important than anything. And, you know, most of the fights that I got into with the partners had to do with Louis. You know, Louis would come up with some radical redesign and they would be like, there's no way, we don't have time. And I'd be like, we have to, like Louis's dead right. You know, I remember there was this fight between Brian and Louis, and Brian got pissed off and he said, you know, either Louis goes or I go. And I'm like, bye.
Right.
You know, because I didn't care.
Well, I mean, you're overworked and you feel that they're not investing in the talent that you think they should be investing in.
It's the kind of thing. And finally,
you got fair?
To, they were hostile to Louis. I mean, it wasn't just a question of not investing in the talent. They didn't like him. They thought he was disruptive to the company. They thought that he was this punk ass kid who wouldn't be managed. And, you know, it got to the point where like, Louis was going to quit. Louis was gone. He was out of there and he said he couldn't take it anymore and he was going to quit. And then, you know, Clarko said, if Louis goes, I go. You know, and I said, well, hold on. Like, this is, you know, this is why I insisted on being a co-founder. This is what that's for. Like, let me take care of this. And so I basically wrote up this, you know, big thing, which said, you know, look, we can't, like, everybody's going to quit. You know, we can't operate like this. You know, we need to
change of course.
We need to change of course. And, you know, like, I won't go into the details. I'm sure I've already infuriated them enough as it is, but,
They're not listening. And if they are, hi guys.
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
I think it's been years. I think it's totally fair to discuss it. And they've gone on to be acquired by Disney. And, you know, they did a lot of, they had a lot of success after.
I guess.
I think everybody will agree that that was certainly a very stressful time for everybody involved.
No, I think so. I mean, it's really funny because Bart is, he's from Belgium. And so he has, you know, sort of connections to, you know, the Netherlands where I live now. And he was like hanging out here with my partner in the New Lemurs. And, you know, my partner's like, hey, I'm talking about this guy Bart de Krim used to work with, you know, and I really, you know, I hadn't really thought about it for a long time, and it was like, you know, he was kind of like, yeah, what would Bart have to say about working with you? And I was like, probably nothing good. You know, everybody I talk to who comes from Tapulous tells me that the company culture is based on hating the hell out of me.
Maybe. I don't know if that's fair so much as like it's like an iconic thing, you know.
I guess all I know is that when people from Tapulous meet me, they tell me, oh yeah, everyone fucking hates you there. You know, maybe it's because, you know, it's me. And so they're inclined to say that, like, it's, you know, I'm sure it probably doesn't come up 98% of the time. And when it does, it's probably like, fuck that guy.
I actually ran into Bart in Palo Alto after having lunch with Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, they were very pleasant to each other, very friendly. Bart was like excited to hear what Louis was up to.
Bart's a friendly dude. I mean, and this was my ultimate conclusion. It was just like, you know, and this is what I ultimately told my partner Flores. I said, you know, look, I don't know what Bart has to say about me. It's probably nothing good, but I'll say this. I loved working with Bart. I loved Bart.
Go ahead.
So, you know, I left and a week later, Tap Tap is on stage with Steve. And it was kind of like, I mean, it was a funny thing, right? Because, I mean, the thing you got to understand is they hated Tap Tap. They hated the idea of publishing a game. And I mean, this was not what they wanted to be doing, right? They wanted to be doing social networking stuff. They wanted to be making Hot or Not, right? This is what Hot or Not was, the app that they wanted to have made that I did everything that I could to prevent from being made by prioritizing other apps above it. Because I thought that Hot or Not was just, I thought it would just make us look like assholes.
Mm-hmm.
And at a certain point, it finally came down to, you know,
didn't you have a prototype or something like that?
Oh yeah, we had several prototypes. Yeah. I mean, at one point, there's a story. It's like it's the weekend before the deadline, you know, and we're not even in the office. We all go into Louis' apartment, and it's like we're gonna get this shit done. We're gonna, you know, stay up all night. We're gonna work on this, and the partners end up like hiring or bringing in some dude to basically make this Hot or Not app in the weekend before the deadline because they're so determined to have this thing out there. You know, and we basically sat down and had a product meeting with the guy, completely changed the app into something utterly different, and sort of, you know, finally we sent him out scratching his head, you know, which I think probably was one of the reasons why, you know, they wanted me gone because of shit like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and at one point they had said, like, you know, we're killing Tap Tap, we're rededicating those resources to Hot or Not. And, you know, I was basically like, I will quit if you do that.
You had very different corporate visions for what your product should be.
No, very much so. And I mean, that was why they didn't want to work with me anymore, because I got in their way and insisted on, you know, on hiring the people I wanted to hire and doing the apps that I wanted to do, regardless of what company they wanted to build.
Right.
I mean, I think that if they made a mistake, it was in hiring me in the first place.
Well, I don't know about that. Do you really think that?
Well,
I mean, if they would have got where they had.
They wouldn't have gotten what they had. But my point is that if they wanted to build the company they wanted to build and not get stuck with the company that I built, then they shouldn't have hired me. They should have found somebody else.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Anyway, so things go south. Everything shakes out. And you're back.
Everything shakes out, yeah. So basically, you know, I'm out, and, you know, I'd say within a month, you know, or two, everybody else was gone as well, inevitably. You know, and when I left, I was like, don't leave on my account. Like, you guys have, you know, a bunch of awesome apps. You know, you have the number one game in the App Store. Like, don't throw that away just because I'm leaving. But the reality is, you know, people were not happy, and that's what I was trying to solve. And so when their response to that was to get rid of me, then, you know, I think people inevitably were going to leave. And, you know, that's pretty much where United Lemur came from.
Right. So explain United Lemur.
So United Lemur, it's actually really funny, because United Lemur was what Tapulous was called before Tapulous, right? I mean, you might remember, I'm sure you remember, working on Lemur Poker back with Chris. And,
Chris,
you know, that,
and Brent was
that,
there too, there, you.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was just like, you know, you and the Seattle crew, and we were going to make this game for the iPhone, and, you know, we didn't know what API to program it to yet. And that was United Lemur. You know, Brent Simmons came up with that name. And, you know, then when Tapulous came along, you know, I was like, you know, well, I only want to work at a company if we have a focus on charity, and we're going to, like, you know, give money to Madagascar. And they were like, yeah, cool, we're totally into that. And so I said, okay, well, then, you know, you can, I don't care if we call it United Lemur or not, you know, we can call it Tapulous, it's fine. So then United Lemur basically became Tapulous. And then when the team left Tapulous, then we just went back to, I mean, we just continued being who we were. We went back to being called United Lemur. You know, and then here's where I screwed up. In fact, I would probably call this the biggest mistake that I've made in my life, which is that, you know, Kleiner Perkins basically came to me and said, great, we're dying to fund you, you know? And so they brought us in, they rolled out the red carpet. We got to work with just the most incredible people. They hooked us up with Cooley. They hooked us up with Silicon Valley Bank. You know, we were hot in the Valley. In fact, I put this, you know, solely on the team, but, you know, we were the hottest iOS team in the Valley, and iOS was the hottest shit in the Valley. So we were the hottest shit in the Valley. Nice. And it was just a question of signing the paperwork. And I said, no, I told them that I didn't need their money, that we were going to make it on our own, that, you know, we were going to bootstrap it. And that was a terrible, terrible mistake. Because you don't say no to Kleiner Perkins.
Right.
Like, the only reason why you're hot in the Valley is because Kleiner Perkins says that you're hot. And if they say that you're not hot anymore, then you're not hot anymore. And you know, doors slam, phones go unanswered, you know, it was a huge mistake that had ramifications far beyond the actual money that we would have gotten.
So why'd you say no? Just because of the, you know, a generally healthy skepticism of VC money?
No, quite the opposite, actually. And this was what was very frustrating about being under non-disparagement with Tapulous. You know, they contractually obligated me to not say anything for 2 years. And so the community drew their own conclusions. And the conclusion that they drew was that this is what happens when VC money gets involved. But the reality is we didn't have that much VC money. We had, you know, $1.8 million in angel funding just because we're doing iOS stuff. But the actual funding never materialized because the partners wanted a bunch of sketchy shit as far as the vesting schedules and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, because they were the ones who were very suspicious of VC, and VC were very suspicious of them. And so my opinion at the time was that VC would have saved that company. Everybody thinks that VC killed that company. But the reality was, you know, perception becomes reality. And I had the whole community, you know, in whom I had vested a tremendous amount of respect and authority, telling me that VC had killed that company and to stay the hell away from VC, and that I had made a mistake in doing that. Everybody looked down on me in doing that, and I should know better than that, and I should bootstrap it and all this other stuff. And then we, you know, came up for some, you know, brilliant strategy for raising a bunch of money and said, yeah, screw VC, who needs them?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was, yeah. That's what it came down to. And so, you know, when the app wasn't commercially successful, you know, the race to the bottom started, the economy collapsed all around the world. You know, the team had to go get jobs, and that was, it was the birth of a lot of great things, mm-hmm. but it was also the end of United Lemur.
And so you moved on.
Yeah. Well, eventually,
Oh, you took a bit of time, eh?
No. I mean,
honestly, I knew you pretty well, and you'd been going flat out for years.
I had been going flat out for years. It's true. I mean, I burned out is what happened, right? Right. Tapulous rolls directly into United Lemur. We have no money. We have no time. So, you know, but at the same time, like Obama and, you know, the whole world is all excited about that. And so we kind of, you know, I think we had a month and we spent half of it working on the Obama app and then half of it working on our app.
So how did the Obama thing come up?
So basically, I'm at C4. C4 happened like immediately after the Tapulous thing went down. So it was kind of like the first time I stand in front of the community and I'm like, well, okay, so that didn't go very well. And so here's what we're going to do. And, I also, you know, said that I would be willing to, if you would be willing to give money to my charity, the Madagascar Fauna Group, I would be willing to do some consulting for you. Raven Zachary was there, and he actually kind of misunderstood what I said and thought that I said that I would be willing to write code if it was a good cause. And, you know, he had basically been putting together this, Obama iPhone app team. With John White and, a web shop, in Portland. And I was like, I was already super into Obama. I'd already done a bunch of work for the campaign and stuff. And so I was like, hell yeah, I would love to get in on that.
And Mantir was involved too, right?
So, you know, so I brought in Louis and Tristan as well.
Got it. So. And was that fun?
No, it was, I mean, I understand, like what we should have been doing was sleeping. But what we were doing instead was, killing ourselves on an impossible schedule, working on something under utter secrecy to the point where, I mean, the period, the United Lemur post-Happiless period, I was under tremendous stress. I had become narcoleptic because, I was only getting like 2 hours of sleep a night. And so, I would just sort of collapse at times and wake up and my like arms and legs wouldn't work. And I'd, crawl like a worm back to my computer and get back to work. I mean, it was not a good time at all.
Does this story get nice at some point? There's a tournament.
So when it all basically falls apart, right? Yeah. First of all, Puzzle Lotto, which is the game that we made to try to raise some money, I think we sold like 200 copies, right? So it just lost a bunch of money. So plan B kicks in. Plan B is to, cash out my retirement savings from working at the airline. But the economy had just collapsed. This was like October, November 08, right? And so that money basically comes in at like pennies on the dollar. Like, it's like, $12 or some ridiculously tiny amount of money, which not only doesn't cover the debts from Puzzle Lotto, it's that itself was kind of a spiritual breaking point, So I'm like, okay, fine, whatever. I have enough in me. I can do one more game. And so I had this great game, put together this great plan where I ended up like meeting this guy who was a firefighter at 9/11. And he like thought he was going to die because the buildings collapsed on him, but he got rescued. And so he like started this like awesome organization, which would take like firefighting to like third world countries. And so I arranged so that we would make a game about fire safety. We would raise that money so that we could bring his group, the Gear Up Foundation, into Madagascar, and we could increase their ability to fight fires and save Madagascar and save kids from fire. And then the economy collapsed, the App Store prices plummeted, and Madagascar went into a civil war. And so all of this kind of happened at the same time. And I just, and then everyone had to go get a job. I collapsed onto the floor and I just started bawling and I just cried. I cried and I cried and I would sleep and I would wake up and I would keep crying. And at one point, after like 3 days of this, I ended up like having a chat with Gruber of all people, who was basically just like, dude, you need to get your shit together. You need to find an even keel. You need to not have these ups and downs. And so it was kind of the beginning of another humble period. I wanted to go away. I wanted to be a monk. But the equivalent of that for a guy like me is to go work at Apple.
Right.
So I had to go get a job. So I went and I got a job at Apple.
Nice fallback line.
I mean, it's the kind of thing where you look back in your life and it kind of it makes me feel like a dick, right? Because it's like, well, then I had to go get a job. So I went to go get a job at this company where
people would like kill to be able to get a job there. Yeah. Well, whatever. It happened. So you spent a bit of time at Apple. You were at DTS and then you were on the App Store team.
The Apple Store team. I am as prone to misspeaking as anybody else. I mean, it's just a confusing situation. The point is this: it's not the App Store, and it's not the iTunes Store. It's the Apple Store app, which is like it's kind of like the .com app. It's kind of like the retail store app, but it's like it's the retail buying stuff. Buying a phone with your phone app.
Right.
Yeah.
It's the one with the shopping cart on it. Right.
The one with the shopping cart on it. Yeah.
Right. So following Apple,
yeah,
you were there for what, about a year and a half, 18 months, 2 years?
No, about a year.
Yeah. So following that, you head out into the wild yonder, right?
Into the wild yonder. I mean, so at the end of my, time with the Apple Store project, I'm looking at it and I'm like, what am I going to do next? Mm-hmm. I mean, that whole department had been sort of reorged out of existence. And so it's like, okay, I got to go do something else. And, the iPad was just a thing. Mm-hmm. And so I really wanted to go work on some, iPad engineering project. But at the same time, I was thinking, what does this company need from me? you know. And I thought, leadership. Like
Steve wasn't doing it for you, so you wanted to.
Well, I mean,
you wanted to step up and.
Steve had been very sick for a very long time, you know, and you know, it's not like, and this is the thing, right? It's not like, you know, tomorrow I'm going to become a manager at Apple. It was more like, you know, I have the ability to do engineering projects, yes, but I also have the ability to communicate and I have the ability to lead. And, you know, the people who are running the company now are not always going to be there, and there's going to need to be people, you know, to replace them. Like, there's going to need to be, you know, leadership for this company long term and kind of thing, you know. And it was also kind of like the other way of looking at it, which is like, you know, if you're planning where you're going to go in the company, then you basically have to make a decision for yourself whether you're going to, you know, find the job that suits you and bore right into it, like. Suddenly his name escapes me. Number 8. You know, Apple employee number 8, Chris.
Espinoza.
Yes, Espinoza. How could I forget his name? I have it tattooed onto my back. That's the problem. No, like Chris Espinoza, right? Like, there's a guy who found the job that he liked and has basically been in it until the end of time. You know, and so it's like, is that the job or do I want to run this company? You know what I mean, right? It's like...
Sure.
You have to think about these things. You have to think big. You have to look, you know, past the next thing. And I mean, that was really the point. The point was not that I felt like Apple needed me to lead it, or that I wanted to lead Apple per se. The point was that I was trying to think beyond just the next thing. I was trying to think.
Sure. You wanted to build up a skill set, maybe? Is that a good way of putting it?
Skill set, right? And like, engineering wise, I I'm as good as I'm going to get, I guess. Like, I'm not saying that I'm awesome, but like, you know, I have made attempts to go deeper and been rebuffed. And so it's like, okay, it's time to work on some other skills. So I thought that basically whatever Apple is going to need me for in the future, given the two options of either taking on a third engineering project or, you know, going on a trip around the world, maybe living abroad. I mean, having some kind of, you know, big experiences that, you know, your average Apple engineer is not going to have. You know, those are the kinds of things that I need to be doing. And so basically I made the decision to, you know, to pack up everything and kind of take a trip around the world and, you know, to consider living abroad, which is what I, you know, kind of ultimately ended up doing. But this is kind of an important thing because every, you know, people always ask me like, why did you leave Apple? You know, it's like, I didn't. You know, I never left. You know, I just did the next thing that I felt like, you know, I needed to do, you know, to pursue my future relationship with Apple, I guess.
So where'd you go? You took a trip around the world and you went on the speaking circuit for a bit, right? Theatrical talks.
Yes. Very theatrical talks. It was like a conference tour, right? You know, all these conferences, you know, some of them were conferences where people had invited me. Some of them were conferences where, you know, I went as a speaker and they weren't all tech. I mean, you know, like I went to Burning Man, which is a kind of conference, I think. And I went to, Comic-Con.
You called Burning Man a conference?
Yeah. Burning Man's a conference.
Okay.
One of those first forays was to Comic-Con and, you know, so that's kind of where the costume came from. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that I did at Comic-Con and a lot of the stuff that I learned on the trip, you know, like basically the talk that I gave while on the trip was kind of like about the trip and the stuff that going on the trip had taught me. And so wearing the costume that I had acquired at Comic-Con was kind of a reasonable conclusion at the time.
So you have a very larger than life sort of public persona, especially on stage. To what end do you employ that? Like, is that conscious? I mean, it's obviously conscious because you don't dress up like a space pirate by accident. But do you have a certain effect in mind? Or, like, are you trying to communicate something? Or like, you must be aware of how theatrical it is, right? To what end are you employing that theatricality?
Well, I mean, I think that the problem is like, you know, if you say you have a very larger than life persona, it's like, I guess.
Is that unfair?
I don't think it's unfair. I just think it's kind of phenomenology, right? I mean, the thing is, it's not like one day I was sitting there in my office in Apple watching a Kanye West video and said, I want to be this guy. It was more like a series of decisions that were logical given their constraints that have added up to this idea of having a larger than life persona.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, that would be a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I don't want to be unfair about it, but.
Oh, no, no. I don't think
there's clearly a degree of stagecraft there that is, sort of unparalleled. Like nobody else does that kind of thing, right?
No, it's totally true. But it's like, if you're looking for like the one underlying thesis, it's kind of hard to provide. It's more like a bunch of like smaller underlying theses that have sort of led to the decisions that I've made.
Sure. That's totally fair. I think even pretending that there's any one thing is going to be totally unfair to pretty much anybody.
No bat crashed through your window and sat on your father's bust and told you to become a Batman.
Nah. I was totally going to make a Batman parallel. So, okay. So why the costumes? Why? And when you speak, you are very forceful and opinionated, and I think that serves the audience well. I think you've inspired a lot of sort of newbies to the field to get excited about design and about thinking about apps in the way that you do. Do you think the theatricality serves that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the relationship between me and ego, you know, like I look at ego and I say, you know, everyone says you should like not have an ego, but the problem is that if you didn't have an ego, then you would no longer exist as an individual being. I mean, your separateness from everything is the very definition of ego. And
sure,
so,
but I mean, the way you express that ego is different, right?
No, and so I think the whole idea is that because I'm from Hawaii, sometimes I say no when I mean yes. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, everybody expresses their ego differently, and so I look at it and I say, you know, it's not a question of not having an ego. It's a question of what am I doing with my ego? How am I earning my separateness from the everything? And I think that if I can inspire other people, you know, to actually do some good in the world, you know, to actually get off their ass and do some work, then that's a great thing, and it's totally worth it. And I mean, that's why I bother to get on stage. That's why I bother to get in front of a camera. And then at that point, it just becomes a matter of, you know, getting your point across and strategic advantage. And it's like, you know, when I get up in the costume and I say, if you're going to make an app that people are going to remember, then you should probably make it memorable. If you're going to give a talk and you want people to remember it, you should make yourself memorable. For example, you might not remember my name, but you'll probably remember the fact that I'm dressed like a pirate or a mariachi or whatever ridiculous costume I choose to employ.
Mm-hmm. Do you get a lot of feedback on that?
Yeah, I guess so.
Is that a stupid question?
Well, I mean, it's not like people take me aside and say, you know,
nice
look,
costume. No, right, yeah. Whatever. But I mean, I've heard you say in the past that part of your job as a speaker is to hang around and talk to attendees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I totally agree with that. What are those conversations like? What's a sort of a typical conversation that you'd have with somebody new to the field?
To be honest, you know, it's actually funny. I was talking about this to somebody because sometimes I'll run into somebody and, you know, I won't necessarily remember. Like, I'm terrible with names. I'm worse with faces. I'm pretty good at remembering conversations I've had, but I'm not the kind of person who sees somebody and then I'm just like, oh, you're, you know, Jim, and we talked about whatever. But, you know, if the person's like, I'm Jim, we talked about whatever, then I'll typically remember them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I have a lot of these awkward situations where I meet somebody and I'm not quite sure where I know them from. You know, and so I've had this happen a couple of times where somebody has been like really upset because we had a conversation that changed their life and I don't even seem to remember it. And, you know, the thing is that when I go into these conversations, like when I'm at a conference and I'm conversing to the people who come up to me, like I have no role in that conversation. I am like a dumb box where they put input in and then I output whatever comes into my mind. You know, I see it as like, you know, the information is just kind of flowing through me and the content of the information is completely for them and it really has nothing to do with me. You know, so I don't necessarily even remember the conversation while I'm having it.
Mm-hmm. So you just open your mouth and shit falls out.
Yeah, kind of. That would be a good way of putting it. I mean,
an intentionally asshole way to put it. What you mean. I know what you mean because you're talking about your own experiences or about your, you know, whatever it is, code and stuff. it's not new to you, so you don't necessarily remember it.
Well, I mean, it's just not only that. I mean, if somebody comes up and they show me their app and what the app does, and they tell me about their life or the problem that they're having at the time, I mean, you'd be surprised the kinds of stuff that people will want to talk to me about. I don't sit there and relate it necessarily to my life. I mean, it might remind me of something that happened to me that I think they might, you know, find useful, in which case I'll relay that. But it's not like I'm not involved in that, right? It's their stuff, and I'm just analyzing the information and returning the analyzed information.
There's an interesting thread from the beginning of what you were talking about, where you weren't satisfied with the status quo at the airline. So you took it upon yourself to learn Java and start making things more in, I guess, the ideal way you saw them. And even though you didn't have, you know, marketing or business background at Tapulous, you sort of took it upon yourself to learn what product picking was like and what packaging products were like. And then you were at Apple and you decided to take it upon yourself to, instead of blaming or sort of looking for people to fix things, you seem to have this real urge and desire to self-start and to make yourself the person ultimately responsible for those changes.
Yeah. I mean, it's my fundamental belief that, you know, it's like algebra. You know, you have to solve for X and you have to solve for yourself because you're the only person who you control.
So what kind of a different insight, because you didn't do the computer science degree before you got into programming, and you didn't do the business school degree before you got into product making and marketing. How does that dynamic work now with people who are more traditionalists in the field?
Well, I mean, I think the thing is that I have to learn everything that I know. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have any of this stuff handed to me. You know, generally speaking, if there's a problem that I'm given, I'm going to have to spend some time learning about that problem. So, like, I know incredibly specific details about incredibly disparate subjects because at one point or another, I had to solve that problem. And because I don't have a general knowledge in how to do this stuff, I had to learn every single thing about that thing until I became a foremost expert on that subject, at least for the time necessary to solve the problem. And a lot of times when I throw myself into a problem, I throw myself in with such utter dedication that, you know, I don't even have a memory necessarily of doing the problem solving process or whatever. I mean, I read documentation that I had written in the past, and it's completely new to me because, you know, at a certain point you stop sleeping, you don't record memories, things like this.
Yeah, you don't write to disk.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like I once had to, I wanted to export to iWeb, and, you know, that stuff, the iWeb format was supposed to be documented, but it wasn't. And they hadn't sort of admitted that they weren't going to document it. So it's kind of in this weird in between state where it seemed like a good idea to reverse engineer the file format of iWeb.
This is back to Delicious Lobby, right?
Yeah. Right. And I mean, at first that stuff looked impossible. I mean, I spent 3 days, you know, just staring at these files and, you know, just, you know, they're in hex edit and stuff. And, you know, finally, or hex fiend, I should say. After like 3 days of not sleeping, I just sort of got into this state where I think I was just kind of appropriately, like I was in the same place where the iWeb guys when they managed to get that working. And you know, it's like drinking when you're studying and then you can't remember anything when you take the test and then you go get drunk afterwards and you remember everything. It's like I just had to be in the same mental state that they were. So then And then I wrote documentation for it. And then I went to sleep for like 2 days. And then when I came back, I didn't remember really anything about what had happened, except that now there was documentation.
Helpful.
Yeah.
So after your sort of speaking tour, you've settled down now in Amsterdam and started a sort of a community out there, right? I think, how would you best describe it?
I usually describe it as an ecosystem or as infrastructure or some other kind of word like that. I mean, you know, it's really it's more a question of organizing things.
You're a man of big ideas, and you are theatrical and you can communicate enough that you inspire people to sort of get on board and come along with you. And I think that's like a net positive for the community. Like certainly like this United Lemurs thing that you were talking about, like the card game. I was all into that because you're so enthusiastic about it. And you have that same kind of enthusiasm for what you're calling Amsterdam. And has that worked out? It seems to me that you've gathered quite a few like-minded people in the city.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Amsterdam has been very successful. You know, it's been running We're celebrating our 2-year anniversary on April 20 this year, having a big party. And most importantly, like, I haven't been running it for the last year. Like, I stepped down as the guy running it after 1 year and turned it over to another team. And, you know, they're about to turn it over to another team. And
is that the plan? Like, 1 year sort of stints?
It sort of became the plan. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't think it's healthy for someone to spend more than a year working on something full time without getting paid for it. Like, you know, that's as much. I mean, the problem is it's really easy to throw yourself into something that is, you know, good and necessary and makes you feel good because it does important things. And easily let the rest of your life, kind of slide into crap. And so I think it's important to put limits on things like this so people don't, you know, go too crazy with it.
Consumed by it. Yeah.
Or find a way to make it so that, you know, like right now, the people who run Amsterdam don't make any money, but, you know, if they could at least pay themselves a salary, then, you know, then maybe it wouldn't be quite so limited.
Sure. So why don't you describe sort of what services or what the community is about?
Yeah, I mean, so the original idea, right, was that I wanted to have a tech conference happening all the time. The features of a tech conference include there's some lectures going on. There's usually, you know, some kind of drinks happening. And there's this real kind of social element of getting together with people who do the same stuff that you do and just talking freely about your ideas and what you're working on and, you know, getting help from each other. You know, there's this kind of closeness that, you know, I think everyone who's really gone to these tech conferences experiences. And, you know, some of them, like NS Conference, that are really kind of community based is, you know, I think that that's a good model for just a general existence. So that's kind of what we set out to do. You know, by sort of being this event community organization, force that, you know, kind of sucks up the resources of time and energy as they become available and dedicates them to infrastructure projects to help bring the community together and to give that kind of conference-y feeling. So if you're coming to Amsterdam and you're here for, you know, at least a week, very likely there's going to be some, you know, there's going to be a lecture for you to see. There's going to be some drinks for you to have, you know, but then it even goes kind of beyond that because making that stuff happens requires and opens up the opportunity for a lot of things. For example, that lecture, you know, requires speakers. Well, at Apple, we have this thing called WWDC. And in order to train the speakers for that, there's this whole speaker training program and these sort of weekly spotlight on lectures. And that's what our weekly Wednesday lunchtime lectures were based on. You know, somebody in the community is working on something. They want to talk about what they're working on. We'll give them some speaker training and, you know, and that's where these lectures come from. And then because that, is happening, if someone like you were to come through town and you'd be like, well, yeah, I'd love to stand up and share some of my knowledge or what I've been working on, that infrastructure exists for you to do that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're going to have people showing up. Like if you came to town and we didn't exist, you know, you might have the idea for that, but actually making that happen, organizing it, you know, everything becomes a one-off thing. Right. That's very difficult, but we already have this established weekly lecture series you can drop right into.
Right. Yeah, it's a nice way of having sort of like-minded people in the city too. It's like a, almost like a permanently running Cocoa Heads or NS Coder kind of thing.
Yeah, very much so. Except that, you know, unlike, like I originally wanted to call it NS Life after NS Conference. But one criticism that I, you know, kind of took very early on in my career, you know, was that I was something of a language bigot, you know, because of my fondness for Objective-C and Apple and Xcode and all of these other things. You know, so in an effort to kind of be bigger than myself, you know, and to make things more kind of accessible for everybody, you know, we really said that, you know, this isn't just about Apple stuff. It's for people of all platforms and, you know, and not just for technical stuff, but, you know, people in marketing are welcome to come and hang out. You know, people who, you know, are like maybe lawyers or, you know, have an interest in apps or like, you know, like the example I like to give are like, let's say that you're in the publishing industry and your whole world is being changed by something you don't know anything about. And you just wish you could just talk to some people about apps and what you should know about them. And that's, you know, what we provide as well.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Makes sense. Being inclusive is definitely almost always a win, right?
That's the theory.
So, you know, we've been going long, but I really want to pimp your app, Lemur Chemistry, because it's a great idea. You spoke to me about this, I think, last year in England.
Mm.
And then nothing came of it from my end. I didn't follow up with it. Why don't you like explain what it is and explain what the impetus is? Because I think it's a pretty, I like the idea and I like the idea behind it too.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, so there's a couple of ideas at play here. You know, really for me, it started out with, you know, feeling like, the best way that I could sort of contribute to the ongoing goodness of the world would be by finding ways to help make people smarter. Because, you know, no matter how you feel about global warming or the future or whatever, one thing we can pretty much all agree upon is that our kids are probably going to have to be smarter than us. And, you know, at the same time, I think most of us can agree that people aren't getting very much smarter. So, trying to just, you know, do my little part to reverse that trend. So I've had a couple of ideas in that regard. One of them is that, you know, I've learned enough about making games that I know that, you know, underlying a game is a gaming system, and that the gaming system is essentially a series of rules that you have to learn in order to be good at the game. And those gaming systems are, you know, they're just made up. Like the game makers just make them up. That's what game making kind of comes down to. And if we could replace those made up systems with existing systems, then just by playing a game, you would actually be learning something. You know, like I've often had this feeling of playing a video game and then kind of at the end of it, feeling like I've kind of wasted my time because I've learned a skill that is not actually useful in the real world, or I've learned a bunch of information that's not really useful in the real world. But there's no reason why I couldn't play that game and feel like I had learned something that was actually useful. Like if the characters in the game were based on historical characters, for example, then their stories would be actual knowledge. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, instead of, say, switching a bunch of gems around, you were switching a bunch of molecules around, well, then you could learn some chemistry. So that was kind of the idea that we had when we went into this stuff of, you know, there's fun in this. There's a lot of fun in this. And then the other thing is, I mean, I think a lot of, you know, even for me, even though I always am thinking about saving the world and stuff, at the same time, there's just stuff that I think would be cool that I'd like to have exist. And when things don't exist, that irritates me and I want to make them exist. And, you know, I've never been able to see just molecules moving around, you know, like it seems like that would be so cool if you could just see molecules moving around. I mean, you see like pictures of the shadow of molecules. You have like, you know, molecules.app, which lets you build a single molecule and kind of rotate it around. But that's not chemistry. I mean, I want to see chemistry. I want to see, you know, like when hydrogen burns in air to make water, like what does that actually look like, right? Not, you know, that big cloud of, you know, the big boom, but, you know, what does that actually physically look like? Mm-hmm. You know, like you see this equation, 2H2 plus O2 equals 2H2O, but that's not what really happens. You know, and what does really happen? Like, I had no idea. Mm-hmm. You know, so we found a chemist and we asked him and we got some research papers and we modeled it and we found some errors in the research papers. And so we went back to the original researchers at Princeton and got the latest data and modeled it. And yeah, it's all very cool. And you know, that's what we built, is the ability to kind of see molecules and to kind of poke at them. And then, you know, we are trying our best to make that into a game.
Mm-hmm. Right. In which you, I thought it was a pretty good idea where you end up watering the plants.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's so recognizable as a really nice game mechanic because you mm-hmm. have these two stable things and then you have to combine them into these, you know, according to combinatorics, these, you know, unstable sort of intermediates. And then from those, you can manage to get to the thing that you actually like. So you go from stable but useless to unstable and dangerous to stable and useful. That's just a very nice little game mechanic. And then, you know, what do you do with water? Well, you know, at first we had it so that you would just count how many waters you made, but that was boring. And so we said, okay, well, then we'll change the plant, the counter into a plant because you water a plant. So we made some plants and then you water the plants and then the plants grow. And that's how you keep track of how much water you make.
Yeah, it's a very cute idea. I like it a lot. And I do like the insight of replacing game mechanics with sort of real life mechanics, or mm-hmm. like learning, like rather than learning simple game mechanics, you're learning the mechanics of sort of the real world. I think that's it's a sort of a noble goal. Do you have any other plans for similar apps?
We do. I mean, so right now we're kind of working on, you know, on the 1.1 version of this game. You know, based on kind of the feedback that we've gotten, so the people have tried it. it's always kind of very overwhelmingly positive, especially at what we're trying to do. But then there's kind of like one of three things that they always want. And so we're trying to deliver on those three things. Mm-hmm. You know, like making the game, like kids get the game right away, but adults find it very confusing. So trying to add a kind of tutorial in there that adults will understand that won't bore children.
So that's an interesting thing. Is it just because the kids will start poking at stuff until they figure it out?
That's exactly right. I mean, the idea of the game is that you just poke around and then you'll figure it out. And kids go and so fight for that.
Adults, yeah, and the adults are too timid. They don't want to touch anything.
No, they're too timid. And first of all, they kind of expect a manual for things. Like they want to know what's going on. Sure. But the other thing is like adults will draw the conclusion that they don't understand the game because they don't understand chemistry, and that therefore their children will definitely not understand it. And the whole point is not that you're supposed to know chemistry, but that you will glean chemistry by observing,
right,
you know, the game system. But it's kind of a, you know, it's kind of a frustration because kids will get it, but adults think that kids won't get it.
They don't have the sense of play and discovery.
No, that's exactly it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's inverting the learning process, right? Which is, I think, effective. But I can see that being a hard pitch to somebody if they don't kind of sort of get that idea immediately.
No, it's really true. So, I mean, there's a couple of things that we're kind of looking at right now. Like one of the big things that people were like they really like the game, but they wish that the atoms looked more like the atoms that they remember from school and a little bit less like lemur faces.
You know, I could see that. I mean,
yeah, I know. I'm very much in the same place. And like, you know, I would really love, I mean, the whole idea was to try to tell a story of a family so that you would be able to relate to things that kids would understand. And, you know, the mama oxygen and the baby hydrogen and this, you know, this compulsion to be together. But it's really hard to tell stories, especially in a visual kind of universal way. You know, and so, well, I mean, it's not so much a question of molecular theme packs, although that is something we've considered. And this is kind of what it comes down to, right? Is that we've kind of, you know, there's this molecular simulator, which is like really awesome and really fun. And then there's sort of our clumsy attempts at making a game on top of that. And so right now we're really looking at it and we're wondering if people wouldn't actually like it more if we just sort of made it a science visualization tool. You know, that like teachers could use or people could just kind of use. Like, I kind of feel like,
well, it doesn't have to be either or, right? You could just,
no, yeah. It absolutely doesn't. And I mean, actually, so this is what kind of where it's funny is that, my thinking at this point is that when we're done with the version 1.1 of this game, we want to maybe try to spin out this little science demonstrator, which would be, you know, different market, a different vertical, different pricing, different everything. But then maybe think about doing it in reverse next time, right? Like instead of saying, okay, what game can we make? And then what, you know, demonstration tool can we glean from that? Like maybe we should start with the demonstration tools and then, you know, kind of fund the game.
Yeah. Maybe find out what's fun about, like, what do people like to do? Like, how do they mess around with the demo tool? And then maybe you can make that a game.
No, that's totally true. I mean, I think part of the other thing is it's just like teaching people is hard and making games is hard, and making a tool that can teach people is already kind of a hard challenge. Making a game that is fun is kind of a separate hard challenge. And so it's, you know, we kind of maybe attack them both at the same time.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Well, I like the idea of the visualization thing. Seems like a good thing to try, at least.
No, yeah, totally. I mean, I think, you know, for me, it's just like, I think science is fun. I think it's awesome. I think it's fun to be able to play with it. And I mean, this was like, this is how we got to the point where we are. I mean, when you and I were talking, the original idea that I had was that it would be fun to have a chemistry set for the iPad.
Right. Yeah. It was a broader scope for sure. And I liked where you went with it because it made it a shippable product, really.
Well, there's that too. But I mean, really, like, my thinking was that if you made the perfect chemistry set for iPad, like just the thing you're picturing in your head when I say chemistry set for iPad, that would be cool, but it wouldn't be as cool as an actual chemistry set.
Right.
Because that's not what the iPad is good at, per se.
Well, you can't blow anything up.
No, exactly. You know, and so then my thinking is, well, what is the iPad good at? And I'm like zooming in on molecules, like actually letting you touch something. That is what the iPad is good at. And like making the visualizer for the chemistry has been the most awesome and fun part. And it's been the part that like everybody has loved. And like, you know, we have this like this really awesome thing that we have a lot of fun with. and we're banging our heads against it, trying to make a game to compete with the, you know, the Angry Birds of the world. Mm-hmm. When it's kind of like, man, I kind of just want to make a bunch of science visualizations because I really have a lot of fun with them. And maybe if I have a lot of fun with them, then other people will have a lot of fun with them too. I don't know.
I think that's a great way to think about products, I think. Certainly can't hurt.
Yeah, yeah.
They're intrinsically fun.
They should be anyway.
Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to see what you come up with.
Yeah, me too.
You mentioned something earlier that I want to just pick back up on. From the very beginning, you said you were interested in charity, and you've mentioned Madagascar several times and saving the world. What's the impetus for that? What's made that a very clear part of your journey?
You know, I could probably point to a bunch of kind of small individual incidents and the decisions that led from those. But I guess, you know, what it really comes down to is that my worldview, my religion with a lowercase r, if you will, is that, you know, some of us, our purpose in being here is not merely to carry on the species, but actually to kind of refactor reality a little bit. You know, that to me is what engineering is all about. It's what design is all about. It's what art is all about. And it's not necessarily something that's pleasant or easy to do. But the problem with reality is that if you're, you know, there to do something, then it's the only thing that you're going to find satisfaction with, regardless of how unpleasant it may be. So I really see myself as being sort of a feature of the planet, with a role to play. And that role is by finding things that I can fix and then fixing them, finding people I can train how to fix these things and then training them.
And Madagascar in specific?
Well, Madagascar for me, you know, the thing about Madagascar is that it seems like a very solvable problem. You know, it's, you have, you know, basically this country that has a lot of resources that are not being well utilized. They're being, you know, rather nastily abused for what few natural resources they have left, but they have a lot of other things. For example, you know, lemurs, like they have this like natural kind of mascot. You know, I think that if Madagascar was, you know, was run, a little bit more like, you know, a startup, I think that they could do very well for themselves. I don't think Madagascar really even needs to be charity. You know, you consider the fact that, for example, like one of the biggest problems with Madagascar right now is that 90% of Madagascar is gone. It's been burnt up. It's just a red Martian landscape. And so you have sort of this rim of surviving, vegetation and animal life, kind
is
of around
it. Is, just to be clear, is that the result of war or logging or both?
I think that the principal reason for the destruction of Madagascar, and certainly war and logging have played their part. But I mean, just bad farming technique, right? Mm. Like in Madagascar, they not only do they not know how to do anything other than slash and burn agriculture, like they believe that the smoke from the fire, you know, makes the clouds in the sky that bring rain. You know, so it just comes down to a simple sort of lack of knowledge and technique, you know, and like I look at a lot of problems in the world and they seem sort of intractable or far beyond anything that I'm capable of. But I look at a situation where you have something that is inherently valuable that's being destroyed because people don't see the value in it and, you know, are using destructive techniques that are solutions to which have been, you know, known for hundreds of years. So if, you know, we're just able to sort of teach them how things are done, teach them how resources are managed, teach them, you know, what they actually have, you know, then they might actually have a chance of doing something. And, you know, they're a good case study. It's not so much that we should save Madagascar and let everything else burn. It's a question of if we can't save Madagascar, then we can't save anything. And if we can save Madagascar, then maybe we have a chance to actually save the rest of the world. Save the lemurs, save the world.